This is an Enterprise Times podcast. My name is Ian Murphy. I'm here with Dr. Jill Strange from Infor.
Yes, thank you. I'm Jill Strange. I'm the Vice President of Science Applications with Infor. My role in the organization is to work with our customers to infuse science-based solutions into our HCM products. Primarily, I work on talent science, which is our predictive analytics solution that helps us to determine whether people applying to an organization will be a good fit for the roles that they've applied to, and then also carry them through career pathing, succession planning with the organization as they continue down that path.
The moment we hear words like behavioral and science, people start to get a little bit nervous. They're not quite sure. How do we demystify this so that it can be understood by everybody?
Part of what we do with our solution is we ensure that it is easy for people to use. Behavioral assessment and behavioral analysis can be extremely complex and difficult for people to understand. But within our solution, we present information back to our users that helps them to easily interpret the data that we're collecting from job candidates and employees within the organization in a way that can really help them to boil it down to the key components and understand what they're really looking at.
What do you mean by key components? Is this, you know, whether that person's likely to disappear off early, whether they're capable of being allowed to work at home on their own without being monitored? What is a key component?
It might help if I tell you just a little bit about our solution within Talent Science and what that is before I go down that road. Within Talent Science, we have a behavioral assessment where we are collecting 26 different behavioral, cultural, and cognitive characteristics about a person. These characteristics can be things like, how ambitious are you? How analytical are you? Do you like to work in a fast-paced versus a slow-paced environment? So things like that, where we're understanding the individual taking the assessment. What we do within organizations is we take that assessment data and we compare that to what we call a performance profile. A performance profile is the optimal pattern of behavioral, cultural, and cognitive characteristics that enable somebody to be successful on the job. What we do with these performance profiles is we go into organizations and we seek to understand what is that optimal pattern of success based upon a job. So if I'm talking about a retail organization, for example, we work a lot in high volume, hourly hiring. And so we have many retail organizations that use us to identify who will be successful within this organization. But a simple example might be, I'm a candidate and I've applied to a sales associate role. I would take the assessment. I would be compared against this profile, and it would tell the recruiter or the hiring manager if I am a good match to the position based upon this profile and kind of the underlying algorithm that has helped us understand who our high performers are, what does low performance look like within the organization, and how can I better emulate what the high performers look like and avoid those characteristics of the low performers. So this profile is really key to the process. Candidates come in. They take the assessment, they get compared against a profile, and the way we get that profile is by looking at data from the organization. So again, taking the retail example, if I were building a profile for a sales associate, I would go into that organization and I would say, I need a sample of your sales associates, people that are doing this job day in, day out, and I want to select them randomly. I want high performers, I want low performers, I want mid-level performers, I want everyone across the entire spectrum. And from those people, I'm going to collect two pieces of information. I'm going to have them complete the assessment so I understand their behavioral, cognitive, and cultural characteristics. And I'm also going to collect performance data from them. And this performance data can take any form as long as it helps me understand who are those high, mid, and low performers. So in a sales role, maybe it's sales per hour. Maybe it's units per transaction. In a call center role, maybe it's average handle time, or maybe it's a quality score or a sales number. It really can be any kind of criteria that helps me understand that performance. Now, some organizations don't have objective performance data, and in that case, we build a performance evaluation, and we help to deploy that within the organization so we have some performance metric to use. But once we have those two pieces of information from the job incumbents, we run that through our predictive analytics system, where we're looking for relationships between the assessment data and the performance data. We're optimizing this profile to where we are more likely to select somebody that's going to be a high performer over a low performer. And then we're rolling that up across all of the different characteristics to create this profile of success that helps us to best identify people who are going to be successful within the organization. The process there helps us to understand success, helps us to understand how candidates match up to success, and can give the organization, the recruiter, the hiring manager, a good idea for how this person is likely to succeed within the organization. Now, I've talked about just one single job, talked about sales associates. But if you think about large retail organizations, big box stores, Lowe's, places like that, those kinds of organizations have many, many different kinds of sales associates. You may have somebody in cabinetry, and you may have somebody in, you know, that's a cashier. You may have somebody that's in garden. And the behavioral profile for success may differ very much based upon what part of the store you're working in and what your role is. So we can also go in, and rather than just building a single profile to cover everything, we can develop specific profiles that will help recruiters put people into a position that will be right for them. So it's not so much you come in, you take the assessment, and I'm eliminating you. We don't make any kind of automated decisions. We're really putting tools in the hands of those recruiters. But we're allowing that recruiter to also look at an individual and say, all right, well, this person applied to a cashier role, but they might be more successful in this type of sales role that I also need to hire for. So it's about putting people into roles where they have the possibility of being most successful.
So there's a big benefit here for a candidate then in giving up that information. But how do we then explain to the candidate when perhaps the job they've gone for, the system says, well, they're not really suited for this, here's a range of others. Because we know in the past when we give information and guidance to an interpreter, if that interpreter doesn't really understand how the information's gathered, they find it difficult to explain going forward, and the whole process slowly unravels for everybody.
Yeah, good question. There are a few pieces of that I'd like to address. First of all, assessment has been around for 50 plus years. It's not a new concept. I mean, people have been assessing people one way or another forever. I mean, if you go back to feeling the bumps on your head through phrenology or looking at hand drag analysis, not the kind of assessment we want, but people have sought to assess people for a very long time. Now, especially in high volume roles and even leadership roles, it's kind of a different approach, but people expect organizations to gather some additional data from them beyond their resume, beyond their experience. Assessment is not something that is unusual. Candidates, we find, expect it. They're not surprised by it. They know that it's something that they're going to have to do. In that regard, that helps because it's sort of socialized within our culture already that people will take an assessment to get a job. Now, as far as sharing information back, that's something that we've seen evolve over probably the last 10 to 20 years. It used to be that you would never give a candidate back any kind of information about their assessment. Your data went into a black box. You would never see it again. Maybe that decision was made based on your assessment. Maybe it was based on something else. You would never know as a candidate. We're evolving to a point now where candidates are expecting some information back and recruiters are responding. The way that we do that is by when we think about assessing and we gather this behavioral data from a person, we know a lot about that person and we can take that information and present it back to them in a job agnostic sort of form. So here's you. Here's who you are. You like to work in a fast-paced environment. You like to do this, that, and the other thing. And we can provide that information back to candidates and not really say, sorry, you didn't get the job because of this. This is just who you are. And we're providing this back to you as, you know, a thank you for taking the assessment. So we're finding a lot of organizations moving down that direction, giving candidates some kind of feedback. Now, as far as giving people their actual scores back and that level of detail, that's not something that has really happened very much within the organizations that we work for. It's not to say that as time goes on and technology advances and we can more readily fit people to positions that may not be the one they applied to, that may be something that we start to see more of.
Raises two questions. They're still with perhaps the trickier of those questions, privacy. If organizations are gathering this data, how do they retain and hold that data? Is it fully anonymized? Is it held by the organization? Is it sent back to yourselves?
With GDPR becoming required back in May of this year for our European clients, we've become keenly interested in ensuring the privacy of everybody. We want to be sure that we are being able to adhere to those standards within the US as well. We are GDPR compliant. We are able to forget people within our system, adhere to all of those different requirements that are in GDPR. As far as just basic functionality, we are able to do that. As time goes on and we see legal challenges and everything work its way through the court, I think we'll continue to refine how we treat privacy. But at this point, we have a candidate terms of use and privacy policy that they are to read through and agree to before they even get to the assessment. As far as storage, we share the data with the candidate. So the candidate owns their data. We also share ownership of that data so that we can use that in our artificial intelligence machine learning processes. But if a candidate does want to be anonymized, they are able to request that. We also, for certain clients, anonymize just upfront. So if that's requested, like we work with the federal government on some accounts, in that case, absolutely, we automatically anonymize everything. And that's becoming more and more requested by our client organizations. So I think that is something that we'll be continuing to work out.
The second question that came out of your earlier answer is, we know there's a paucity of good talent out there. And we know that people are going to come across our desks who don't quite fit today. And it might be for a range of reasons. We just may not have the right opening for that person. We've started to see companies holding on to CVs. They don't do it terribly well. They try and keep a marker, and then when the next position comes up, they go back to a filing cabinet of CVs. How many of your customers are starting to look at this as giving them an opportunity to continually revisit candidate opportunities, to look at who they've seen before, rejected, but now meets an opportunity, so that they can go back to that candidate and say, look, we know you didn't make the previous job, but actually we have one open for you now. Are you still interested? Is that happening, or is that still something that's more talked about than physically in play?
It's beginning to happen. It's talked about a lot. We've actually circled around that within Infor for several years, trying to figure out the best way to approach that problem, because you're exactly right. People need to best utilize that talent that's already in their applicant tracking system. Every time you open up a new job requisition, you have to go out and start from scratch, when in fact you have a lot of people in your system more than likely that could be a great fit for the jobs that you're showing. The technology is coming out. I went to HR Tech just a few weeks ago, and there are multiple companies out there that are helping organizations to do this. This is something that we're looking to get into. But yeah, so that's definitely an issue for clients, and we want to be able to help them with that.
When you build these profiles, how do you ensure the profile is accurate? You mentioned yesterday something about doing a validation against a body, a corpus of data.
When we're building profiles, we're held to the standards of the EOC, so the Equal Opportunity Commission within the United States. Back in 1978, they released a set of uniform guidelines for assessment and selection procedures. This is 40 years old at this point, but it's still the standard that we are held to, and we continue to make sure that we are building profiles to adhere to those standards. Now, when we adhere to those standards, what we have to do is a validation study, like you mentioned. And there are a few kinds of validation studies. What we do up front when we build profiles is called a concurrent criterion validation study, which I know is a mouthful. But what that is it's an empirical way, a data-driven way of looking at the effectiveness of an assessment solution. The way you do that is you take your job incumbents currently doing that job, run them through the profile so we get a score for them. Some people are going to score very highly because they're a good fit and likely a high performer. Some people aren't going to. And we simply correlate that with our performance metric. If I build a profile where I'm trying to predict sales, I would have those incumbents run through my profile. I would look at the sales numbers for those incumbents, and hopefully I'd have a strong correlation between sales and performance on the profile. That's the first line of legal defensibility. We also, when we're building profiles, ensure that we're not biased toward any one subgroup, protected group, because obviously that's something that we would not want to have in our system. We're able to essentially take our database of candidates that we have built over the years and run them through the profile as well. So if I'm building a retail associate profile, I can find retail associate candidates in my system, run them against my profile, and I can see, am I potentially biased? And how do I fix that if I am? Is the profile going to be very lenient and let everybody through? Is the profile going to be very harsh and screen everybody out? All things that we don't want to happen. The power of the data behind the system allows us to ensure that the profile is going to be valid, predictive, and non-biased and useful.
Removing bias is always a challenge. Some biases are easy to see. We can look at racial stereotypes, we can look at gender stereotypes, we can almost look at cultural stereotypes, but others are difficult to spot. Is somebody, for example, autistic? That's very hard to spot. Somebody who may have a medical condition who may not interview well, particularly if we're using video cameras or we're using facial expressions or body expressions. How do you remove that?
That's a very good question. That's a very big question, because there are a lot of different ways to approach that, depending on where in the process you're talking about and what potentially the bias could be. Take colorblindness, for example. That's one kind of disability that potentially an assessment could be biased against a person like that. If you're in a situation where you're building assessments and you're putting things online, you want to have the little button that turns everything to black, white, grayscale. That would be one way of approaching that specific type of disability. If we're talking about autism, like you mentioned, or any kind of other clinical mental disorder, that really comes into play when you're developing your assessment. for every assessment item that we use within our assessment, we've not only piloted it against 150,000 people per item. If we see any kind of oddity in the item, be that any bias that we're talking about, we would throw that item out and not use it because we don't want to build that into the instrument that we're using to evaluate people to begin with. We also have items reviewed by clinical psychologists. If we write an item, and you know, I'm not a clinical psychologist, I'm an industrial psychologist, so I'm not 100% familiar with the aspects of the clinical side. You know, if we have a clinical psychologist review these items and say, all right, well, this one could potentially be biased against somebody with autism, or this could potentially be biased against somebody with a learning disability, we can identify that as well and remove those items too. When it comes down to it, building an assessment to get to 125 item assessment, we usually go through about 3,000 items before we get to a final product because we want our assessment to be most predictive. We need it to accurately measure the different characteristics that we're measuring, and we need to make sure that this assessment is going to be legally defensible, not biased.
The other side of this is how do we stop creating people who are clones of everybody there? We all know people who at some point in time have taken on a job role that we thought they'd never succeed in, and they've blossomed. Or they bring something left field to that job role and it turns out to be that little bit of extra magic sauce that suddenly makes the company a lot of money. How can you factor that in?
Two things. First of all, the profile is a tool. We would never say, you're a good fit to this profile, you will 100% be perfect for this job, because there are a lot of other things that come into play. You need skills, you need experience, you go through your interview and things come out in the interview that could be a red flag and maybe you wouldn't want to hire that person. This is a tool in the toolkit of Recruiter and the hiring manager. Beyond that, when we build a profile, we have these 26 characteristics, but certain characteristics are weighted more strongly than others. For one job, maybe the ability to take risks is very important. For other jobs, it may not be at all. So with each profile, we typically have 5 to 7 characteristics that are really differentiating the high performers from the low performers. When somebody comes in and they take the assessment, they're compared against that profile, the better matched they are to those top characteristics, the better their score is going to be. The other characteristics that may not be so important is where you see a lot of variability in people. As you're bringing people into the organization, yes, they may have some characteristics that are similar on the heavily weighted side. Maybe we're all ambitious and we're all analytical and we're all very disciplined. But when it comes to sociability, we're all very different because that's not built into the profile as a highly weighted characteristic. You know, maybe for a fast-paced versus slow-paced environment, we're very different. In the end, you're not creating clones because there's a lot of variability in the profile overall because personality has a lot of variability.
Companies are incredibly complex organisms, and we talk an awful lot about the need for better teamwork, better collaboration. A lot of my time is spent talking with developers, talking with software companies, where we talk about the whole issue of development processes and complexity. And within that, getting the right team makeup is incredibly difficult. We all like to think it's easy. We like to think we can quickly throw these teams together and make things happen. During the panel session, there was a discussion about creating pods and how you're able to select. If I look at Agile and DevOps and movements in the software industry, we found it incredibly hard to actually get the right mix of people in those teams. In some of your clients, those who are using this in particular, how much of this has changed their ability to make up the right teams?
This is something that's still very much in the research and development phase because teams are incredibly difficult to put together effectively. It's still a field that we're really moving to really determine the best way to go about doing it. The pod model that they discussed on stage yesterday was also accompanied by part of the HCM presentation where they talked about team dynamics, looking at people's behaviors to determine whether they'll be a good team or not. The reason I say this is in the research phase, this is something that we've worked on within the Talent Science Group for several years now. We actually won Awesome New Technology at HR Tech last year where we were showing when people are a good behavioral fit to each other. Independent of the job, we found that when people are a good fit to each other, and again, early research here, people are similar in their personalities. And I know we could talk for hours about, is it better to be similar? Is it better to be different? And what we find is that when people are similar in their personalities, they are more likely to stay together as a team longer. Psychological research has showed that, our research shows that, and that's not to say that we don't want diversity, because absolutely we want diversity. You want diversity of experience, you want diversity of background, you want diversity of job. You know, obviously you can't just throw people together in the same position if you're trying to get a cross-functional team. Diversity is absolutely important. When it comes to personality and behavioral characteristics, we find that similarity is actually very important. If I'm very extroverted and you're very introverted and we're supposed to be on a team together all the time, it's possible that it would be difficult for us to work together long term because we're very different. And obviously, that's just one example, that it's not to be generalized. I know that's a vast overgeneralization. When we look at other characteristics and we look at on the whole, if people are similar in personality to each other, we find that they turn over less often, that team is better performing, and that it does result in good things for the organization. Within Talent Science, what we've created and what one awesome new technologies was looking at behavioral fit of a team overall and seeing how aligned they were. And that's the product that we have right now. It's a product that we are working to build into talent management because the real power from that is going to come from taking the behavioral fit of people and also bringing in what job are you in, what's your managerial hierarchy, what skills do you have that you can bring to the table so that we can ensure the diversity of skills and people and experiences and also the similarity of many behavioral characteristics that are going to lend themselves to people staying on the team together longer.
At the moment, this is part of your wider HCM solution, which is great for large enterprises. But when we look at small to mid-sized enterprises, they have all these problems, but probably magnified. They don't know what a high performer is. They're very susceptible to a bad team member. How do you turn this into a cloud service, a software as a service that people can subscribe to? Because again, many of those small to mid-sized companies can't afford to go and use a recruiter who's bought a license.
Is that it is standalone as well. So we work with a lot of organizations standalone with Talent Science, and a lot of those organizations are smaller. To build a profile, we typically need a minimum of 40 people in a role. More data is always better, but we can get a good predictive profile with a smaller number of people as well. So we do work with a fair number of small companies when we have Talent Science standalone. We also, by virtue of the fact that we've built thousands of profiles over time, we can create industry standard profiles. Maybe I have a retail associate from four different types of stores. I can take all that data, I can standardize it, and I can build an industry profile. While we don't get to bring in the culture-specific aspect of each retail organization, we can start to look at what are those characteristics that are really differentiating high-performing retail associates from low-performing retail associates broadly. And a lot of our smaller organizations use that, those industry standard profiles.
It's a fascinating subject. Dr. Jill Strange, thank you for your time today.
Thank you so much.